This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Freedom of the press is written into the United States Constitution, and with that freedom comes responsibility on the part of journalists and news operations, but also a sense among the citizenry of how a free press must function in a democratic republic like ours. The press, which has morphed into the media, has always had an adversarial relationship with those in power. We're called the Fourth Estate for a reason, and that reason is to monitor the political process in order to ensure that political players don't abuse the democratic process. It follows that politicians and others in powerful places have not always been the media's biggest fans. But over the last 20 years or so, the ground beneath us has begun to shift, and recently that ground has been shaking because of thunderous denunciations, mostly by President Trump. Mr. Trump's condemnations are aimed at individual reporters and various news organizations. To help make his point, he coined the hashtag Failing New York Times. He's characterized mainstream publications and their correspondents as dishonest peddlers of fake news. Last weekend, he tweeted that major news outlets are the enemy of the American people. And during a press conference last week that quickly devolved into a session of Beat the Press, he spelled it out again.
Many of our nation's reporters and folks will not tell you the truth. The press has become so dishonest that if we don't talk about it, we are doing a tremendous disservice to the American people. Tremendous disservice. We have to talk about it to find out what's going on, because the press honestly is out of control. The level of dishonesty is out of control. I want to see an honest press. I started off today by saying that it's so important to the public to get an honest press. The public doesn't believe you people anymore. Now, maybe I had something to do with that. I don't know. But they don't believe you. If you were straight, I would be your biggest booster. I would be your biggest fan in the world, including bad stories about me.
Are these the comments of a president who needs a thicker skin or a tactic to divert attention away from something else? Is he merely playing to his red meat base, conditioned by others to distrust the lamestream media? Or does he have a point? Has the media lost its way? What should our role be? And can we fairly lump the wide variety of sources labeled the media into one category? Is the New York Times in the same league as Breitbart News? For that matter, is CBS News equivalent to Fox News? Given the prevalence of alternative facts floating around out there, how do you, as a consumer of media, know who is telling you the truth? We talk about that this hour with veteran journalists, former CNN White House correspondent, former ABC News correspondent, now Dean of the College of Information and Communications at the University of South Carolina, Charles Bierbauer. Thank you for rejoining us, Mr. Bierbauer. Nice to have you with us again.
Good morning, Mike.
Also with us is Ryan Thornburg, Associate Professor of the School of Media and Journalism at the University of North Carolina and former online managing editor for U.S. News and World Report and the Congressional Quarterly. Thank you for being here as well.
My pleasure.
And as we go through this conversation, you may want to join in with questions or comments of your own. You can do that. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Charles Bierbauer, let me begin with you. As a former White House correspondent and someone who has spent more years in the White House than any president since FDR, let me start with you. In your experience, has anyone...
That's a constitutional restriction. They can only stay eight.
That's right. In your experience, has anyone in the office of president or in Congress, for that matter, ever referred to the press in the manner in which the current president does?
Ooh, ever, Mike. I'm sure they probably have.
In public.
Not necessarily in public, but certainly there have been times when a president or those who surround the president might have had disparaging things to say. Richard Nixon comes first to mind, of course. But I think in regard to the relationship between the presidency and the press, there is always going to be some tenuous aspect to it, because it is the role of the media to expose what is going on and tell our audiences, our readers, our viewers, our listeners, without any particular political agenda, but to just say, what's going on here today that we need to know about, and convey that. And if it happens to be unfavorable, it's unfavorable, and that's more the president's problem than it is that of the press.
Hmm. Professor Thornburgh, the allegations that the media, meaning the mainstream media, will not tell you the truth started years ago from sources mostly, I think, on the right. Correct me if I'm wrong. But before we talk about the validity of that criticism, talk about what this constant drumbeat of the media is dishonest is doing to our democracy.
Well, I think it's much more challenging to be a news consumer today than it's ever been. You know, one of the nice things about the growth of the internet as a news source is that it's given consumers a lot more options. So they don't have to just follow one news source. And that diversity of media, I think, overall is a good thing. But it makes it harder to be a citizen. You have to discern which sources you're going to trust and which you're not. And what we know is that people tend to go towards sources that support the way that they already see the world. And, you know, when you – yes.
No, that's okay. That's okay. The president says we have to talk about – yes, he just said that in that cut we played – that we have to talk about the dishonest press because the level of that dishonesty is, quote, out of control. At mainstream media outlets that apply journalistic principles, is there even a scintilla of truth to that statement? I don't know which one of you wants to take that.
Well, I think either of us could jump on that. And part of my role is to explain, as an academic, as is Ryan, to 18, 19, 20-year-olds and sometimes their parents, why someone should go into this business, which is being so roundly denigrated and disparaged by the president of the United States. And the reality is it's a perfectly legitimate business to go into. And indeed, it's a vital one. You noted its constitutional origin in the First Amendment, or its constitutional protection. Its origin certainly goes back well before that. We believe that a free press, and free means essentially unfettered, to go out and sort out and find out what is taking place and what it means. It's not merely what is happening that's important, but what does it mean to the news consumer, to the citizen? And you do that in the best ways possible. It doesn't mean that every report is going to be 100% accurate, because we do get bad information. Situations change. Circumstances that may appear today to be a murder might turn out tomorrow to be a suicide. Those are kind of evolving aspects of journalism. But the job is to report it as best you can, to analyze and interpret it, and not to get out with a story that is patently false, or even inadvertently false, if you can avoid that. But what Donald Trump is doing is really using the same approach that he took with his competitors, both politically and one would imagine on the business side as well, is simply to cast people in a disparaging light. Whether it's the fake press, or lying Ted, or crooked Hillary, and on and on and on. We've all heard the litany. That's his modus operandi. As journalists, we can kind of shrug and then keep going about our job.
But that kind of talk resonates, obviously, with his with his base and a certain number of people who may not be fans of the president per se, but they are certainly in the conservative end of our political spectrum. And among those same people, many of those same people, it's been fashionable for years to accuse the New York Times of being a liberal rag that lies about conservative policies and politicians. It's for the same amount of time, it has been fashionable, I guess, since Dan Rather anchored CBS Evening News, for CBS to be pointed to as this liberal, untrustworthy entity. Why? I guess the liberals would look at Breitbart News and Fox News and see the same thing on the opposite side of the spectrum. Why?
Yeah, you know, let me weigh in on that, Mike, because I think that the mainstream reporters and journalists don't just have a problem with conservative Americans. I think that you know, over time that we know that negative campaigning works, and we know that overall trust in the media is very low. And I hear liberal criticisms of mainstream media for being too corporate in the same way that I hear conservative criticisms. And so, you know, sometimes it makes me feel good that we hear it from both sides. But I do think that this is a challenge. I do think that the the fact that we don't have a shared media experience across the political spectrum is a big concern.
Have we ever?
Well, we certainly have when we've had a lot fewer choices. So when you had three national television networks and when you had, you know, one newspaper in a town and you didn't have the internet, and some of the criticism that came with that was that the coverage was not diverse enough, that that the coverage would, you know, essentially cover, you know, middle class white America. And so with, you know, some of the advantages of this media diversity are also coming challenges. And so it's not, you know, the press has to up its game. It has to say why we are important. It has to explain why we do what we do and why we're valuable to democracy. I don't think that we can just sit back and say, well, we have this protected status in the First Amendment and assume that people will trust us simply because we're here.
A lot of people are frustrated with government because I think in part, and this is my theory here, that we haven't been teaching civics lessons in schools for a very long time, evidently, and they don't understand how the government works and that it was meant to be deliberative and slow-paced. And in our fast-paced society, we just get frustrated with that. What I'm hearing from both of you a little bit here is that we need to teach media literacy. We need to teach consumers of news how to view and analyze the producers of news. Is that accurate?
Well, that's a fair characterization, and media literacy is a current hot buzz topic, and to some degree it stems from the assault that Donald Trump has launched against the media, not solely Donald Trump, but he's the current protagonist in the discussion here. Sure, we need to have a savvy news consumer, and to do that, you have to be aware, as Ryan has discussed, the spectrum is so broad now that you can spend the whole day sitting in front of one screen or another, and maybe even picking up a printed newspaper or magazine, and still get only a slice of the spectrum, and that is the difference. I grew up in that three network, two local newspaper, and half a dozen radio station environment, and that is such a fraction of what all of us have available to it at the end of our fingertips these days. So media literacy is an important piece of that, to understand if I am watching show X, network X, reading newspaper X, where does it fall within that broad spectrum of political interpretation, not even necessarily taking a political stand.
And Ryan Thornburg, you kind of alluded to this a minute ago, that the media is responsible in some part for what's going on right now. John Dickerson, host of Face the Nation on CBS, says that the media can blame itself for ruining its own reputation. About 30 seconds here. Do you agree with that statement?
Somewhat, but I also think, you know, part of it is that we give airtime for Donald Trump to say that the media is the enemy of the American people. So, but that's part of our job, is to give him that platform.
We're talking with Ryan Thornburg, who's an associate professor at the School of Media and Journalism at the University of North Carolina, a former online managing editor of U.S. News and World Report, and Charles Bierbauer, the dean of the College of Information and Communications at the University of South Carolina, former CNN White House correspondent and ABC News correspondent, among many, many, many other credits on both of their parts. We're talking about the media and whether Mr. Trump's criticisms of the media are valid, why they might be going on if they're not, and we will continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley, a full-service law firm with attorneys that are experienced in serving the banking and financial services industry in Charlotte and across the nation. Details at Bradley.com. And Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, a local nonprofit blood center serving the region's hospitals and patients. Individuals can host a blood drive or give blood before traveling, since the need is always there. CBCC.us. Tomorrow on the local news roundup, the CIAA tournament comes to town. It's the last tournament standing due to HB2. Governor Cooper proposes pay increases for teachers over the next 2 years, major cuts at Lowe's corporate offices in Mooresville. And we get an update on student assignment, along with some new numbers on people choosing charter schools. Our roundtable of reporters dives into those stories and more on this program tomorrow morning at 9.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up on the next On Point, Democrats hold leadership elections Saturday for the party's national committee. After Trump's victory, how do they rebuild and start winning again? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join the conversation from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, the president and the media. That's the topic. Today we're talking with Ryan Thorberg from the University of North Carolina and Charles Bierbauer from the University of South Carolina about all this, both involved in media for long, long periods of their career in and out of academia. President Trump has referred to the press as the opposition party. Richard Nixon told Henry Kissinger the press is the enemy. Carl Bernstein of the Washington Post, who helped break and investigate the Watergate story, said that this president, President Trump's language in this instance, may be more insidious and more dangerous than Richard Nixon's attacks on the press. I believe, Charles Bierbauer, you may have been around then reporting on this. Do you agree? And if so, or if not, why not? Or why?
I didn't report on the Nixon White House, but I was certainly around and aware of it. I covered the Reagan and Bush Senior White House. I think it's more dangerous in the fact that it is pernicious, repeated, and blasted across the internet, especially on Twitter, which is Donald Trump's favorite social media. Probably is the only one that he really indulges in to any degree, and because it's then unmoderated. We often talk about a moderated or mediated press. That is to say, the president says something, the news organizations, and when I was at the White House, we reported it. What the internet does, what social media accomplishes, it allows the president or anyone in any position to sort of circumvent the media filter, some would call it, or the media analysis. So many people are getting an unvarnished and unanalyzed, an awkward word, but approach from what Donald Trump is saying. Yeah. If they choose to believe it, so be it. The media have to be thick-skinned. We don't have to particularly get terribly upset because Donald Trump or anyone else calls us names. That's not the point. The point is to just keep doing the job that we're tasked to do. Can we do a better job, as Ryan suggests? Oh, absolutely. We're not always as effective, as efficient as we'd like to do. But every day you keep telling the story as it moves forward and trying to add value to it in that regard.
Ryan Thorberg, this question has to deal with CNN. I'm going to give it to you because Charles Bierbauer used to work there, and I don't want to taint the answer. The president has been picking on CNN in particular a lot. And we have these two other cable news networks, one slanted to the right, one slanted to the left. CNN seems to be firmly in the center. Why is he picking on them and not MSNBC?
Well, in the other day when he sort of cited what the fake news media was, he cited the New York Times, NBC, ABC, CBS, and CNN. So it's important to look at what he's actually talking about is the media, that he's talking about these very specific television networks, and that's where most Americans get their news. The challenge is that CNN today sits in the middle. We know that 40% of Trump voters said that they got most of their news from Fox News. On the Clinton side, it tends to be, 5 to 10% get their news from a variety of sources, with CNN sitting in the middle. And so it may be that that's the reason that he's, targeting those sources. But what he's not talking about, are the media institutions that we know people do have trust in. I think that if you look, people do trust their media. It's kind of the way that people don't like the way that Congress is doing its job, but are approve of their member of Congress, or that they think the American educational system is broken, but they think their school is doing just great. If you ask people that watch Fox News how Fox News is doing, I think that they would say that they would like it. And I think that that's true for small, rural newspapers in America as well, that we've done some research here that shows that most people that still read those, local newspapers would recommend them to a friend. And that's a pretty high compliment. And so when we talk about who is, you know, what the media is, it's not just national TV news. It is the New York Times. It is the Washington Post. And it's, you know, my concern is that disparaging journalism generally hurts the ability of reporters to do their jobs in Charlotte, to cover what's happening in city and county government in North Carolina and the things that really most directly affect people's lives. That there's this great, you know, interest in national politics, but the place where journalism can have a big impact is locally.
But essentially,
and that's where we send a lot of our students.
But essentially, the president is pointing to all of the major news operations, the ones that have devoted an immense numbers of dollars and other resources to the gathering and dissemination of news, the New York Times,
but Mike,
the Washington
Post. Those are brand names, Mike, and that makes it easier to do that, to say CNN is this bad and the New York Times is that bad and CBS is a problem for this, that, or the other reason. I think Ryan's absolutely correct. The closer you are to the news organization, the more likely you are to trust it, whether it's your local public radio station in Charlotte or your local newspaper or your local television. They're the ones that bring you the weather and the traffic and the sports scores and tell you where the fires are and the congestion might be. And so you are much more closely related to them than you are to someone who sits on the CNN anchor desk in Washington or the CBS anchor desk in New York. That is very common. By the way, there's a new Quinnipiac poll out from Quinnipiac University up in Connecticut that says 52% of voters trust the media, while only 37% say that they trust Donald Trump. So we're not the bottom of the heap anymore. I don't want to. No,
well, let's go back
small defensive moment.
Yeah, let's go back to polls for a second, because one of the things that the president has said is that the news media lost credibility by failing to anticipate his political rise and his victory over Hillary Clinton. So my question is this. A lot of the polls that did not predict his ascendance to the White House, some of them were independent polls. Some of them were CBS News / somebody else polls, New York Times / somebody else polls, etc. Is the reporting by the media of the results of polls an indication that the press is no longer credible? I mean, is predicting the outcome of an election and getting it wrong the same as reporting the facts surrounding unfolding stories? Is there a difference, or is it the same?
Yes, there's an absolute difference. I mean, the poll is a snapshot. It's a measure at a given moment or over a period of time. Polls are typically done on a rolling basis over 3 days or 5 days, whatever the particular pollster may be trying to accomplish or being paid to accomplish, for that matter. But a poll is just that. It's a snapshot. And if you looked at the polls preceding the elections, yes, almost all of them predicted that Hillary Clinton would win. Here's one of the issues with polls. Many of them are done on a national basis. Elections are done on a local basis, which is why we have the whole Electoral College, another show's worth of discussion, perhaps. So a national poll gives you one snapshot, but you need that kind of pointillist painting of the 538 electoral votes that draw the picture after Election Day. And with regard to the polling in this election, most of those polls fell within the margin of error. What really happened, and the reporting was not inaccurate to say, Hillary Clinton is leading by 2 points 24 hours before Election Day, but everything broke. All of the swing states, including North Carolina, broke Trump's way, and they all broke late, and they were presumably influenced by the FBI disclosure, the FBI letter from James Comey. A lot of things happened late. The polls, when you go back and look at them, were not significantly off the mark when you factor in the margin of error.
Ryan Thornburg, given that liberals will be quick to tell you that Fox News is the sounding board for the right, if we allow the liberals to believe that, must we also allow conservatives to see the New York Times, the Post, CBS, MSNBC as doing the same thing for the left, or is this some sort of false equivalency?
Well, I think this is one of the business challenges that journalism faces right now, is that it's much easier to sort of get 100% of a fraction of the total audience. And that's what Fox has done. I mean, there is a business reason that Fox has done what it's done. And there's a business reason that MSNBC has, over the course of its existence, moved to the left. The challenge, I think, for the business of journalism is how do we bring people together? And as advertising moves digital away from print and broadcast, and it goes primarily to Facebook and Google, what can we do with algorithms to bring people together instead of drive them apart? And what can we do with conversations to bring people together rather than drive them apart? You know, I think one of the great things about the media is it has sat in the middle of this national conversation between average everyday people and powerful people. And we should be bringing those groups together. Mm. We should be giving voice to the voiceless wherever they are in the political spectrum. And we should also be connecting insiders with outsiders. If you look at the national news and look at, well, the polls were the problem. I think one of the challenges is really that national news organizations didn't understand voter sentiment because of the way that we sort of have to kind of fly into, you know, Appalachia, for example, and then fly out. So, you know, I talked to reporters and editors both at the Associated Press and the Washington Post who said, look, we did stories on rural white voters and nobody read them. We could not promote those stories enough. Everybody wants to read the horse race stories. And, you know, do we know today why Graham County went 20 points more for Donald Trump than it went for Pat McCrory? I think there's a lot of work that we need to do with building a network of journalism and connecting people in rural areas with people in urban areas, with people across the racial spectrum, and getting them to talk to each other rather than a business that drives people apart.
Brent emails, isn't it ironic that a man who spends so much time consuming media has such animosity towards it? If you hate it so much, why do you watch it all the time? I would say that the president is looking for affirmation. It's very important for him to be popular in his own head. Is that not the case with every president, Charles Beerbauer, that they all want to be popular?
I'm not sure whether they care about being popular. I don't think Lyndon Johnson cared nearly as much, perhaps, as Donald Trump did. Lyndon Johnson was possibly the most effective manipulator between the White House and Congress because he understood Congress and he knew how to exert power. To some degree, and I'm saying this from a distance, Donald Trump is still learning how to utilize the power of the presidency, which is dramatically different from the power of the TV boardroom that he used to inhabit on his TV show.
It is a very different place. Yes, and let me ask you a question about that, because prior to the inauguration, you wrote that Trump and his team will arrive at some working relationship with the press corps just as his predecessors have once they get to the White House. Is that what we're witnessing?
I guess that was wishful thinking. let me tell you a very, very brief story that Ronald Reagan used to tell. Ronald Reagan, when he was president, would recount how someone on Capitol Hill, a senator, would pound on the rostrum up in Congress and say, I'm going to go down to the White House, and I'm going to tell that SOB president what's what. And then they come down to the White House, they come into the Oval Office, which is a rather auspicious place, not large and daunting. It's not a palace, but they'd come in there and they'd say, Mr. President, so nice to see you. Thank you for taking time. There was something about the aura of the Oval Office and the respect for the presidency that affects people. And when I wrote that, I thought, will there be a different Donald Trump from what we've seen on the campaign once he gets into that office where Ronald Reagan and Lyndon Johnson and Abraham Lincoln and all the others before him had to carry out the responsibilities of being president? So far, he is pretty much stuck to his basic mode of operation.
Randy emails, this mistrust began when the FCC dropped the rule requiring television stations to provide news as a service. Then they became a profit center, which was ratings driven. It then became profitable and almost necessary to make the news more interesting to grab the viewer's attention. I'm not sure that's completely accurate, but I think also if we're going to get an answer to that question, should we not add in the cancellation of the Fairness Doctrine And what's the other one that went by the wayside? It's skipping my mind.
Well, the fairness doctrine doesn't apply to cable.
Right.
So you've got a different set of rules.
The equal time amendment. That's the other thing.
Equal time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that simply says, more than simply, but says that if you give one candidate time, you have to give the other candidate time. It applies to buying advertising at an equal low rate. The difference is that what the FCC did do, because it gives out the licenses for over-the-air broadcaster radio and television, is it required this element of public service, and news was seen as part of that, and your broadcast or the kinds of things that I do down here on South Carolina ETV is part of that. It's public affairs programming. But where you get away from that, and the point is partially accurate, is that the news organizations, especially the television networks, discovered that the formerly 15-minute evening newscast could be a profit center. Ted Turner said, hey, can we do news around the clock, 24/7 news? And some people laughed at him, and others discovered that he made a very tidy amount of money for Turner and CNN by creating this round-the-clock television news network.
But the Fairness Doctrine seems to be a real key piece to this, because prior to the Fairness Doctrine, you did not have these radio programs like Rush Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham and Michael Graham and others, Sean Hannity, all coming from the right, as happenstance would have it. You didn't have that because you had to provide equal time, did you not, to the other side of a controversial issue. That's not happening anymore. You can go ahead and put the right on if you want to all day, or you can put the left on all day. It doesn't matter. Ryan Thornburg, how does that play into this?
Well, I think that's right, that these rules sort of as media diversifies and we're not relying on the public broadcast spectrum as much. And I think that that's something that both the news businesses and citizens should watch, is the further regulation of the internet and net neutrality and how that's going to play out and what role what the connection will be between their pipes, Verizon and Time Warner Cable and AT&T, and the content that's delivered over those pipes is going to be really important.
But Rush Limbaugh is lumped into the category of the media, and rightfully so. But Rush Limbaugh does not operate, and he'll tell you this because I interviewed him once, he does not operate as a journalist. He's just a guy.
Right.
He used to be a disc jockey, for crying out loud.
And we're all just a guy, right?
We are all
part of the media, And I think that one of the challenges is not just media literacy that we were talking about before, but are we creating a generation of media makers, or are we creating a generation of passive consumers? Go down to your local high school and ask what kind of support they have for a free and independent student press, and that'll tell you what kind of citizens we're creating.
Ryan Thornburg is an associate professor of school at the School of Media and Journalism at the University of North Carolina. Charles Bierbauer, dean of the College of Information and Communications at the University of South Carolina. We continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and H&S Roofing and Gutter Company, providing roofing and gutter services for residential and commercial customers in the Carolinas since 1939. More information at hsroofing.com. Democrats vote this weekend on the party's next chairman. How does the party rebuild in a Republican-controlled Washington, and how Democrats start winning again? How can they start winning again? Ray Suarez is in for Tom today on Point, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. By the way, Charlotte Talks and WFAE both are hosting. We're getting together. We're hosting a public conversation on immigration and its impact on the region next Tuesday at 7 p.m. at the McGlowan Theater, and we will talk with immigration experts and law enforcement about immigration policy and enforcement, and hopefully you will participate in that conversation. You can get details and register at WFAE.org.
May 3rd, 1971, the first broadcast of All Things Considered. Since then, a lot has changed, but what hasn't is that we bring the news of the day to life through sound. Listen every afternoon.
Hear the latest news from NPR, plus WFAE news updates from the Charlotte region on All Things Considered. Weekdays from 4 to 6:30, weekends at 5 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the media, its trustworthiness or lack of same, according to the president, with Charles Bierbauer, formerly with CNN and ABC News, and Ryan Thornburg, formerly with U.S. News and World Report, and the Congressional Quarterly. They're both at the University of South and North Carolina now. Scott emails, call me paranoid, but the ultimate danger here is that if there are long-term nefarious plans or goals on his agenda, a great way to get away with it is to convince we the people that they can't believe what will be reported about it. Debark the watchdog and you have a much better chance of burglarizing the House. Could the president and his allies be attempting to diminish trust for their own purposes?
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you think that's happening?
Yeah. Go ahead, Charles. You weigh in on that.
Well, yes, in the sense that we talked a little bit about this before. If you can deliver an unmediated message, in other words, what Trump does with his tweets and what the entire White House press operation is to do is to try and get news directly to the voter, to the citizen, without the mediated influence of the mediator. If they can accomplish that, and this is not particularly novel in and of itself, direct mail was the first approach to that, I suppose. The town crier may have been a voice of the central establishment rather than the media. So if they can get to the voter directly, then or even disparage the media to the degree that the media are not trusted sufficiently, then they accomplish what they're trying to do. I mean, all of what we're talking about used to go by the name propaganda.
Yeah.
And when we start talking about fake news, we're really talking about propaganda. Fake and news is almost an oxymoron when you put them together. It's not news if it's fake. It's a message that's meant to persuade.
But usually propaganda is associated with the government producing it, and the president is accusing the mainstream media of producing fake news, although they have been known in the White House, in the current White House, to put out their share of of completely unsubstantiated or provably false statements. So how would you define fake news in this atmosphere? Or propaganda? Is it coming from the New York Times or is it coming from the White House?
I think it's important.
Not propaganda coming from the New York Times. It's the New York Times' best attempt to deliver the news of the day with analysis and an understanding of what it means. If it's coming from some unspecified blog, online news operation, something that we're totally unfamiliar with, but may have a vaguely familiar sounding name that sounds like it could be a news organization. I don't want to particularly pick one out. That could be crafted as a fake news. And some of the fake news is being done for political purpose. Some of the fake news is being generated in odd spots, let's say the Balkans or East Europe, for simply to attract eyeballs and clicks and revenues.
Well, this is where we're running. This is where we run
into fake news.
This is where we run into problems, Ryan Thornburg, because yes, the media is being lumped together. So you have the New York Times and all the traditional news organizations, and then they're in there with Breitbart News. They're in there with all these other things that you get on Twitter, these websites that you can go to get information, be it true or false. And we know that there were people prior to the election purposefully posting fake news on websites. And people lump all this together and say, the media lies. Well, they're not the media, are they?
Well, I think that this is, you know, they are the media, but they're not journalists and reporters. And I do think that language and words really matter. And so, you know, I'm sort of in the camp of hate the media, but love journalists. And I think that we need to separate what Donald Trump that is doing that is normal from what he is doing that is not normal. So it is normal, and journalists need to expect all of us put our best face forward, right? We all have public relations campaigns. You know, my university has a well-oiled public relations machine, and I'm thankful for that. But as journalists, that shouldn't bother us. We should be skeptical. What I think concerns me the most of what Donald Trump is doing that is not normal is that he will stand up at the White House and say things that show a patent disregard for the truth. When he says that he has the biggest Electoral College victory in history, and that's demonstrably not true, and he doesn't seem – he sort of shrugs his shoulders at that. I think that that's a disrespect for the truth. We are all entitled to our own opinions, but we are not entitled to our own facts. A fact is a fact, and we have to respect
that. Let's talk about that for a second. The president, his press secretary, his assistant Kellyanne Conway have all been caught making statements that have been proved wrong, that stretch the truth or have found to be outright untruths. Should the media, journalists, the press, etc., should they be afraid to call something a lie if it is a demonstrably false statement?
I can't imagine any purpose for a free and independent press if it's not to call out lies.
Well, because NPR has said that it will not and cannot use the word lie because it implies intent. And as a news organization, they have no way of determining intent. Other outlets have said certain statements were lies. Which is the better approach?
Well, I would call it what it is. And we're parsing words and we're getting into semantics if we're saying it's not a lie, it's a false statement, or yes, it's hard to gauge intent unless it's obvious, but look, throughout history we've seen these kinds of things. Richard Nixon said, "I am not a crook." Well, he wasn't a crook per se. He didn't break into the Watergate offices, but he covered it up. Ronald Reagan said, "I did not trade arms for hostages." If you follow the money trail, essentially he did. And those things had to be corrected. Was it his intent to lie, or was it his intent to deceive, or maybe to throw the media and the public off the track, off the trail of whether the money went for arms and went for rescuing hostages? What we are seeing in the Trump White House is what, for all intents and purposes, appears to be rather purposeful evasion of the truth. Is that a nice euphemism for lie?
Well, is it also a form of presidential prestidigitation? You know, it's kind of sleight of hand, a diversionary tactic to take your gaze off what really is important or going on behind the scenes and putting it out here on these demonstrably false statements or pointing fingers at journalists and calling them liars.
Well, he's got the power of the presidency. He's got all the trappings: the White House, the Oval Office, Air Force One, and if you respect the presidency, that's fine. But you don't necessarily have to respect the application that is coming out of the Oval Office when you know it's patently false.
You've said, Ryan Thornburg, that ultimately it will be up to the American people to decide whether the press is on their side or whether the president is on their side. How is that possible, though, when there are news outlets for every ideology and in an era where everyone and anyone can be a publisher?
Well, I think it's not just – I think it's important to note that America needs to have trust in its president, and it needs to have trust in a free and independent press. This is not an either-or question. I think, unfortunately, right now, a lot of Americans look at both the presidency and the press and sort of throw up their hands and say, you know, a pox on both their houses. And that's not good. I think that the adversarial relationship between the president and the press makes both institutions stronger. You can think of this as, you know, sort of a scrimmage that, you know, makes both sides commit and make their arguments stronger and based on facts and share a common, you know, a common goal, right? And I think that there are common American values that we can all share. So I don't know that we need, as journalists, need to take the bait of the president saying that he is at war with us. I think that if we go to work every day and report the facts and the truth for the American people of what's happening at school board meetings all the way up to Congress and explain to them the value in doing that, I think you can't – you know, not reporting alone and just standing aback is not enough anymore. And that sort of idea that we can be at a detachment from our readers I think is changing. I think that our audiences need to know that we have their best interests in heart, and we need to explain why that's the case.
How much of the problem here has to do with the speed of everything today. Years ago, when there was a morning and an afternoon newspaper, you had to wait for that paper to arrive. Yeah, you had hourly newscasts on the radio, but they were usually headline devices. And then you had to wait for the evening news to come your way on television for a half an hour, and that was it, until the next day. Today, we have all these 24-hour news networks, and we have constantly updated newspaper websites and other websites that are not associated with necessarily journalists, but they look like journalistic websites. And people are getting their news all the time. And on CNN, Charles Bierbauer, as you well know, if you're in this 24-hour news cycle and you've got to feed every hour all these different shows that are on the air with developing situations, with news breaking as you're on the air, you can't know everything and you can't get it right every time. And even if you got it right the first time, it may have morphed by the second or third hour into something different. Are people savvy enough to see that as what it is, a developing story being reported as accurately as possible at the moment versus you lying to them because 2 hours ago you said this and now you're saying that?
Well, that comes to the question of media literacy that we talked about earlier. What your question here is almost an echo of conversations that I can recall having when I was covering the White House for CNN with producers who would say, we need you in the 3 o'clock show, the 4 o'clock show, and the 5 o'clock show. And my response very often was, well, it would be nice if I could go do some reporting in between because I don't have anything new from the last hour. Mm-hmm. Part of the response to that was, well, the audience changes. It's not the same at 3, at 4, and at 5 o'clock. Keep us as up-to-date as you possibly can. But I think your point is accurate in the sense that we not only have the constancy, it's on 24/7. I've got the TV on in my office pretty much all day. I'm not watching it. It's in my peripheral hearing more than vision. But it is there. So it's both the constancy and the ubiquity that we've got something coming at us at every moment if we're so inclined to pay attention to it. And in that same way, the president or his spokesperson have access to the media almost any time they want to. If the White House says the president's going to have a news conference at 2 o'clock, the networks, for the most part, are going to cover it. Mm-hmm. There were times back in my time at the White House when we say, do we really want to cover this? We already talked to him this morning. What's it all about? So as not to almost automatically knee-jerk give the president airtime anytime he wants it. The news organizations are businesses, and they have to make some decisions. But right now we're in a situation where the president of the United States, Donald Trump, is so unpredictable, so volatile, and there are so many unanswered questions about what he's likely to do, going to do, that you have to be attentive to it.
Brian in Huntersville writes, the media must be colorblind and report without bias, and they need to drop the political correctness. I think Trump's frustration with the media is due to this sort of thing. His frustration is shared by many in this country. Well, what his fans like about him is his lack of political correctness. He tells it like he sees it. Does the media not tell it like we see it? I mean, do we sugarcoat the pill? Ryan?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that you hear a lot about is concern about the story choices, I think, that a lot of news organizations make. And you see a lot of people that say, look, what I'm seeing on television doesn't reflect the world as I know it. And part of that's because we just as individuals can't possibly see the entire world. And it's the job of reporters to bring, you know, the other into our homes. But I think that this question of detachment and bias is a real concern. I think we, you know, need to understand how we can have our own personal beliefs but have some sort of professional detachment. And I think it's a matter of professionalism and serving the audience. I think what Brian is saying there with his email is a serious concern, but it's a concern that we need to tackle as a business problem and tackle it as how do – you know, what is it that we can do to gain the trust of our audience?
I've heard one analyst say that the media plays into Mr. Trump's hands and those of his supporters when they defend themselves by parroting the president's own words back at him. That analyst says the media should never use the term fake news or even alternative facts. They should simply pound away at the facts as they know them. Yes or no? Good strategy? Ryan?
Well, we know from research that that one of the challenges with this really good fact checking that's going on is that when you repeat sort of a false statement or an assertion, that people tend to remember that more than the correction. And so there's a challenge in that, and then we have to learn how to do that a little bit better.
And Charles Beerbauer, and I only have about 30 seconds here, but given the balkanization of news and so many outlets reporting things, and some of them are obviously biased, at least to me, others are not obviously biased, at least to me, how do consumers determine which outlets are practicing sound journalism and bringing them the facts as close to being unvarnished as possible?
I think they have to treat it like a smorgasbord. You cannot just sample one news organization and have a good perspective. As you suggest, the Balkanization, well, the Balkans were made up of a myriad of small states, and they're not all alike down there.
Right.
I remember when Ronald Reagan flew back from Latin America and said, those countries are not all alike. The news organizations are not all alike.
Charles Beerbauer, the Dean of the College of Information and Communications at the University of South Carolina, Ryan Thornburg, Associate Professor of the School of Media and Journalism at the University of North Carolina. Thank you both for the hour.